Hi, everyone. Welcome to the new season of Teaching Matters. We're really excited to kick it off, and we have a great episode to start the season off with. I don't know if I've ever told this story before, but if you're a longtime listener, you might be able to catch me on this. If I think back to when I was in kindergarten, which would have been probably around 1975 or 76, I remember very distinctly at the end of the year, or towards the end of the year, my teacher, and who was the special education teacher in the school that I went to, and my principal, took me into the special education room. I had no idea what was going on, and they set me down in front of a little desk. On that desk was a toilet paper tube that had been cleaned off. My principal, who I had deep respect for, and still to this day think he was one of the greatest principals that I had, he asked me to pick up that toilet paper tube and look through it like it was a periscope or a telescope. So I did that, and I used my right hand, and he said, "Scotty," which is what I went by in kindergarten, he said, "I want you to use that hand from now on when you're coloring and writing." And I said, okay, and that's what I did. Now, why did that happen? My teacher, who was very diligent, Mrs. Strathy, had noticed that over the course of the year, I had been coloring and writing with either hand, so I was completely ambidextrous. I also think now, looking back on that, that I did the classic reversal of letters. I was an atrocious speller all throughout grade school. Well, then fast forward, you know, several decades, and I end up, you know, going to college, and I can think of different times in my life where I felt like I made a big jump academically. I got out of some of the problems that I had that my teachers would have labeled as dyslexia. Did my mind change? Did I become a better student? I don't know. The answer to those are probably all yes, but that's really what we're going to talk about today, about how the mind changes and how we as educators can help understand and perhaps even facilitate that. That will be our topic of conversation on today's Teaching Matters.
Welcome to Teaching Matters, a podcast exploring all things teaching and learning. Teaching Matters is produced by NPR affiliate WOUV Public Media in Athens, Ohio. And here is your host, Dr. Scott Titsworth, Dean of the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University.
Thank you so much, Trinity. My guest today, I'm really excited to have on. Her name is Tara Bonner. She's joining us to talk about how we think and learn. Tara is the Chief Neuroeducation Officer for the Aerosmith Program. Aerosmith is a research and theory-based organization that provides solutions to education institutions and other human service organizations aiming to help people unlock their own ability to think and grow. Tara has served as a principal in one of Aerosmith's schools and is now a leading consultant for organizations seeking to explore applications of neuroeducation to provide solutions for learning. Tara, it's great to meet you, and thank you so much for being my first guest on this season of the podcast.
Thank you, Scott. It's a thrill, and thank you for being curious about the brain's role in learning and in where education is moving these days.
Absolutely. It's exciting to talk about it. And I think as we delve into this topic, I think every teacher, every parent, even students that are listening will immediately understand applications of the word neuroplasticity to their lives. Before we get into that, though, you have an interesting background. You've been working in this space for quite a while. Can you kind of talk about what brought you into being interested in this idea of, you know, how the brain functions and how it plays a role in students' learning experiences?
Very naturally, I would say, because I spent many years in classrooms, typically primary classrooms in mainstream settings, both in public and in private ed. And I was drawn, as many teachers are, was drawn to students, perhaps like you, drawn to students who seem to have somewhat of an inconsistent learning experience, clearly bright, but not always able to access that intelligence, or frankly, even feel that they themselves were capable or were as bright as there were moments of spark. I was drawn to those kids who were struggling, whether they had been diagnosed or just seemed to be, again, having a bit of valleys and mountains of their experience, that inconsistent experience. I took it upon myself to try and figure that out. And very honestly, I couldn't. I worked desperately hard to connect with them. I knew that that worked, that psychological safety that we now understand to be somewhat of a baseline of importance for learning, trust, even humor, connecting with students and building a relationship with them was something I found to be incredibly valuable in my support of them. And I worked really, really hard to leverage that relationship so I could connect them with the content. Of course, that was my responsibility primarily, was that they leave my classroom with a certain set of skills, with a certain collection of knowledge and content. I often fell short with that goal. And even when I had provided all kinds of tools and tricks and strategies and ways to have them connect with certain bits of material or content or skills, I wasn't entirely sure that they would have those for life, that those lifelong competencies and qualities that we hope to have for ourselves, to help for our children, to provide our students. I wasn't sure. I wasn't confident that they were walking away with that kind of experience. In fact, that was often proven to me when I would be chatting with their next teacher, and their next teacher was scratching their head the same way. And depending on the teacher, depending on the time of day, so that that head scratching, that curiosity, sometimes manifested as frustration or misunderstanding or mislabeling. So I knew I hadn't quite made that connection between what was really happening for those students and how I could be of service to them. And it was probably, this is where my own sense of time and even math can be a bit hazy, but probably 10 years into teaching, not quite, I came across what ultimately changed my career, and it changed even how I personally understood myself and others. It was an opportunity to understand ourselves through what I now understand as a cognitive lens, to understand learning through how the brain operates, and to understand that we all have, we all know this, of course, intuitively and even very factually, we all have this magnificent organ, this 3-pound organ within our skulls, and yet it is highly unique. That more than our, more than snowflakes, more than our fingerprints, our brains uniquely shape how we see the world, how we engage with learning, how we see ourselves, and of course, we'll come to this in our chat, but that in fact, we can also shape that brain. So when I came across the work of ultimately the field of neuroeducation, that we can understand how we learn through understanding the brain's mechanisms, and we can shape how we learn through those same mechanisms, through harnessing our brain's capacities.
So when I began with my story, you know, it sort of put a lens of differently abled learners on our discussion up to this point. Before we go forward, I would assume that you would ascribe to the fact that understanding the neuroplasticity of brains is not only relevant for differently abled learners, but it's important and critical for all learners. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it behooves us to recognize, I mean, this is, there's a lot of buzzwords going around these days, Scott, but inclusivity, to be inclusive within the class, to have equity within the class, is to recognize what it is we all share, and our brains, our unique, what I'll call a cognitive profile. So that is our unique system of cognitive brain strengths and weaknesses that we all have. Of course, they are on a different continuum. We will have strengths and weaknesses in different aspects of our cognitive capacity, but we absolutely owe it to ourselves and owe others the dignity of understanding all of us through this cognitive lens. Absolutely. I don't think this is only for those who learn differently. Mm-hmm. I think that the only way to truly understand how even those who learn differently is to understand how we all learn.
So let's dig in a little bit into the idea of neuroplasticity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, without a deep history lesson and one that you would likely be able to correct me on much better, when we started testing things like intelligence quotient and developing metrics for learners, mm-hmm. there became a view that dominated psychology for a period of time where there was essentially, this is what your intelligence is, mm-hmm. this is what your IQ level is, mm-hmm. and it became a very fixed understanding mm-hmm. of what a person's potential intelligence was. And then it started to transition, and you ascribe to a very different view of the brain, one that involves the word neuroplasticity. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that fixed brain approach and why that was so problematic, and then transition into what a neuroplasticity perspective on the brain is?
Absolutely. As you said, we could have an entire series of a podcast to describe the history of even standardized measures of intelligence and of capacity and how deeply problematic it was. And though we can give our forefathers and mothers some grace, because of course it was largely in part to design our educational system as we know it. At once upon a time, it seemed really important to understand what someone was capable of, because during the Industrial Revolution, and mm-hmm. I promise we won't go too deep into this, but I think that there's value here in context, of course, to understand today. Let's explore yesterday. We had to create a working class. We had to have these industries functioning. We had to have workers and we had to have leaders. We had to have managers. So we needed to understand what people were capable of. And we built an educational system to feed that industry. So we built an educational system that defined very, very early those who could and those who couldn't. And perhaps to some extent, those in between, although we typically have seen really just the cans and the cannots. And that fixed brain mentality, that fixed brain assumption, that fixed brain view was, as I said, it designed our educational systems. It designed how we move through education. And I will say again, it also tended to determine how we see others, how teachers see students, how students see other students, and how we ourselves see ourselves as learners. So to talk about how problematic that is and the implications of that, again, is a whole other podcast or series. But my sense is your listeners will know exactly the incredibly damaging impact of being told as a first grader what you're capable of and what you're not. And I appreciate that I'm talking at a systemic level. I appreciate mm-hmm. that, Scott, you, your principal, your teachers, there are individuals and there are entire staffs and entire schools, we hope, that don't necessarily subscribe to, well, if you can't do this now, then you'll never be able to do it. Right. If you can't read now, you'll never be able to. But there is something there in that fixed mindset, in that sense of, well, if we can't do it now, we'll have to figure out another way of doing it. We'll have to work around that inability or that learn differently. We can't change ourselves, so we have to change the environment around us. So even when we moved past a very incredibly limiting and incredibly, I would say, cruel way of understanding our learners back in the previous century, let's say, even in the 21st century, even the most, I would say, well-meaning and well-intentioned education system still assume that the brain is fixed, that we can't impact our brain on a structural or functional level. So if someone does have a difficulty or learns differently or struggles significantly, we can't change that learner. We can't change that learner's on a cognitive level. So we have to change everything around them. So it came from a time where we didn't have the science or the technology to understand the brain's capacity to learn and grow and change. It came at a time, those assessments that you were describing, those IQ tests that you were describing, it came at a time where society and culture and our economy needed to understand who was most capable, or even who was most capable in certain competencies, certain jobs. And mm-hmm. So again, it makes sense, right? It makes sense that our education system was built on that premise and that it has moved that way for now decades. I would say, I'm delighted to say, I know I'm not the only one who thinks differently about the brain, never mind my colleagues and never mind the schools that we support in my work. But I know there are teachers like your principal, educators like you, Scotty, Scotty, I just referred to your childhood name. I'm thinking
my parents would be very happy. So
truly, I'm thinking of you in that moment, truly, when you were describing that experience. It was a poignant moment for me, mm-hmm. and I'm so grateful that it was as empathetic as it was, and how understanding as it was, and how action oriented it was. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, well, Scotty, you can't do this, so you're going to go in this class and you're going to be put with these others who also cannot, and that will be your trajectory in life. Mm-hmm. And you need to think differently about what your future looks like. College mm-hmm. isn't for you. You know, all of those tendencies that frankly still happen, I would argue still happen. I'm deeply happy to hear that you didn't have that experience. And I know, as I said, I'm not the only one who really is committed to supporting learners in as impactful and even creative ways as possible. So I believe that even intuitively, all educators know, at least good educators, I will be that provocative. A good educator knows that the brain is not fixed. Mm-hmm. A good educator knows that they have a direct impact on their students' ability, even if they don't look at it from a neuroeducational perspective. They know that they can make an impact. They know that their students are growing and learning every single day.
So as we think about, I mean, there are certain realities to the brain. It's only, you know, so big. And as you mentioned, it weighs about 3 pounds. We can't easily see inside of it. I mean, certain technologies allow that to some extent.
Yeah.
So when we say that the brain has neuroplasticity, what does that actually mean? How can we conceptualize that for people who are not brain scientists?
Yeah, there are all kinds of analogies, and I love them all. But I think the one that is perhaps most easily accessible, even tangible, is that for many, many, many years, scientists thought that the brain was like cement, set early in life and unchangeable. And in fact, the brain is more like clay. It can be shaped and reshaped at any age. And even that is a relatively newer insight into our brain's plasticity. But our brain is more like clay. It can reshape, be rewired at any age. Excuse me. And in that reshaping, it itself operates differently. It can change functionally and structurally. And because it shapes all that we do, our every action, our reaction, that harnessing of our brain's plasticity can be positive. Frankly, it can be mm-hmm. negative. We can talk about that too. But I hope that that is as literally tangible an experience as possible. The fixed brain concept is that the brain is like cement, starts somewhat plastic, but very early in life, it dries up, it's unchangeable, and you're stuck with that cement structure versus clay.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'll let you pause for a second if you want to get a drink of your coffee.
Thank you.
When I was telling my story at the beginning, I have definite recollections both in high school and then later in college where I felt like I thought differently as a student. In mm-hmm. other words, I almost, you know, can pinpoint some, you know, some general moments in time where I felt like my brain started to work differently mm-hmm. or I started to work with my brain differently. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when I'm talking with college students, I always do a first-year student welcome. And I always tell them, you know, when I was in college, I remember there was a point in time where I felt like I wasn't just reacting to a class. I was trying to, I use the term attack, not in a mean way, but if I know what the assignments are and I know what the syllabus says I need to do to succeed, I turned a corner where I was trying to not just succeed, but excel. And I think that, you know, there are moments in time like that where I can think about how I was interacting with my learning environment, my own learning abilities, and it was different than it was before. And I don't know what caused that necessarily, but that idea of the brain changing over time resonates with me for those reasons. How long does that change take place? I mean, you know, you point out that the brain is not cement. It does have neuroplasticity. Is this the type of thing that going well into adulthood, like my age now, where there's still changes in the way that my brain operates?
100%. I am not calling either of us dogs, but absolutely old or aging dogs can learn new tricks. And for mm-hmm. sure, for even in the last decade or so, it was thought that definitely is the case caught that plasticity, let's call it that, our brain's mm-hmm. plasticity is at its peak in childhood. Mm-hmm. And it does, its plasticity, again, if we think about this clay, to some extent, it slows a bit when we get older, but it never goes away. We have, so you mentioned at the top of this chat, we provide neuroplastic programming to individuals and organizations. There are people in their 80s mm-hmm. that are strengthening certain functions in their brain through brain exercise, through neuroplastic exercise. So it absolutely, as long as we exist, our brains are capable of that growth. It may take longer. It may take more intensity as we get older. But there's other variables that actually may respond, may allow our brains to respond even better. Motivation, for example. You just named your experience in college. Now, I think I'm hearing you've already described two very different skills, one reading as a younger child, and then as an older student having a drive. Mm-hmm. Now, absolutely, drive is somewhat, you could argue that's a psychological trait. And though what is underneath that psychological trait are two very specific cognitive functions whose job it is to be curious, to generate ideas, to drive to solutions. You clearly, Scott, have strengths there in what often is called executive function. We have it in our left and our right hemisphere. So one is language oriented. One is more so common sense or nonverbal in nature. And you clearly have those strengths. You have those strengths. I know already from even this experience that you are not merely an educator. Your goal is to impact a wide audience. That takes a cognitive intelligence and a cognitive strength to even problem solve all of those elements to make this happen. There's an ambition. There's a cognitive ambition that you hold versus other cognitive functions, phonemic awareness, visual memory for symbols, perhaps even you mentioned there's a cognitive function that motor plans our eyes tracking across text. So if that's weak, even to some degree, our eyes are going to miss track. They're going to get off track. They're going to miss a letter, miss a word, lose our place. So those, some of those decoding functions, they're lower order, but they, it's how we read. It's how we learn how to read, is this certain network of cognitive functions. So absolutely, our brains can always be harnessed for positive plasticity. And yes, it may take other, it may take a different type of intensity. Let me just repeat that motivation piece, because there are some, we can chat about this, or I can share this later with you and you can share it with your audience. But there are what we consider these principles of neuroplasticity. It's a science. So as any science, there are these core principles, these core conditions, let's call them that, conditions for ideal positive neuroplastic change. And one of them is engagement. Our brains must be engaged in that task. And if our brains are engaged in that task and motivated towards that task, it increases the likelihood of that plasticity happening, of that rewiring or that improved connectivity between and within our neural systems.
So I think we're naturally making a transition then to me asking the question, if we both agree, or we all agree, that the brains, that our brains have the ability to grow and change and adapt over time to these ideal conditions, what are some examples of the types of things that educators might be able to do? I mean, it's really the curriculum of Aerosmith. What is it that I might be able to do as an educator that facilitates that change in a positive direction? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And I would always say there's a foundational step even before that. And as you say, we've already acknowledged it. Let's assume that we all know, we all agree that the brain can change, that it's capable of growth and even of improvement throughout our lives. And there is always value in a little bit more specificity. So even a little bit more recognizing, I mentioned these different cognitive functions. Our prefrontal lobe have a certain job, a responsibility in our learning. Some elements of decoding, our visual memory and our phonemic awareness, are our other functions. I would always recommend an educator, a parent, an individual starts to, pardon the pun, like flex that muscle, that cognitive muscle, to understand the specific cognitive functions, the specific and unique cognitive profile that we all walk around with. And the reason why I think there's value there before plasticity, before changing or improving, is that understanding, that awareness of our unique cognitive functions. Because there's understanding there, there's compassion there, there's tolerance there, and there may be, there very likely will be a different way of operating with that person, or a different way of understanding ourselves, even self-compassion, when we understand what our cognitive strengths and weaknesses. And I can tell you a little story for myself. There is a cognitive function that's responsible for essentially conceptual reasoning, for connecting the dots. It's that light bulb that goes off in our heads when we get it. Aha, yeah, I get it. It's responsible for logic, for comprehension, as I said, for conceptual reasoning. It's a hugely important cognitive function. And if it is even mildly underfunctioning, because let's keep in mind, not only do we have unique cognitive profiles, but each of our, each cognitive function, our work looks at, I don't know, between almost 20, there's lots of cognitive functions we have, but let's assume that we all have a number of cognitive functions and they're operating on what we call a continuum. They're either incredibly weak, impaired, incredibly strong, gifted, or somewhere in between. So the cognitive function that I'm describing, it's called symbol relations. It's this light bulb that goes off in our heads. If that's underfunctioning even mildly, it's going to have an impact on the degree to which we understand something. the speed with which we understand something and the depth of what we understand. I know now, I didn't know for until I was well in my 30s, that this was a mild deficit for me, a mild weakness. And my personality was shaped from that reality. And it meant that I was not the sharp one. And I happen to have a brother and sister who are the sharp ones. They're very capable, very successful. My sister is a corporate lawyer. My brother is a biologist. So I had to pivot, right? I had to do something a little bit differently. So I became the funny one or the silly one or the friendly one. And I would pull away from debate. My family are... my parents are both academics, so there was a lot of debate in at the dinner table about world issues or about whether we should finish our broccoli. It was a highly active, intellectually stimulating family, and I pulled away from that because I knew I couldn't compete in real time. And I was okay with that sometimes or not, and I sought a career that I could lean into my my EQ, right? My connection with others. And it wasn't until I came across this work and I had the opportunity to work on an exercise. And I only then realized not only not only was I avoiding certain careers, certain situations, because I wasn't able to, in real time, make those connections, but even some of my strengths, like ask a lot of questions, I thought that that was a perceived strength of mine. I thought I was interested. I'd asked lots of questions. I asked lots of questions because I didn't actually understand. And I needed a couple of different questions. I needed to go at it from a different angle. I needed someone to describe it to me differently, because conceptually I wasn't able to grasp it really quickly. So that's a long way of saying, had I known, and even had others around me known, that it wasn't that I didn't want to engage, it wasn't that I wanted to make a situation silly or fun instead of being perhaps focused and serious and problem solving, but it was that it was more difficult for me. So for an educator, for a parent, and for us ourselves, if we come to a situation or come to someone else with an understanding of what are the cognitive functions that are contributing to someone's experience, I think it will serve all stakeholders. So that would be the first recommendation I would give. And there are ways to understand cognitive function in really specific ways. And there are even ways to define, even self-evaluate cognitive functions to have an understanding of that. So can that be our first principle, our first foundation is to come to a situation with an understanding. And then the next are, I believe, what a lot of great teachers are already doing in terms of how to give students the best chance they have to be towards positive brain change. I know that a lot of great educators and a lot of great teachers are encouraging engagement, encouraging attention, encouraging investment in a task. And that is absolutely a positive condition for neuroplasticity. Have it be of interest, have it be motivating, have the task be something where that person, that student can very clearly say what's in it for me and drive towards that. So that would be one. I'm going to pause there because I know that I'm giving a lot of content here. Is that a helpful construct?
Absolutely. And I love your story because I think that it perfectly helps people understand how, as they're interacting with a student, a family member, how this idea of, you know, certain strengths and certain areas for improvement in cognitive function can have manifestations that you may not look at and think, well, that's something that we need to work on. Like, you know, if I was in your family and you were not debating, but you were making, you know, humor out of something, that might just seem very natural and I might write that off, but yet it links back to an area where you as a student could, you know, figure out ways to develop strategies for, you know, having that insight, that aha moment in data points and maybe asking questions is that. I also completely agree with you. Over the course of, you know, being an administrator in higher ed, I've had various moments in time where I've been asked to fill out different sorts of cognitive assessments. Typically, it's because, you know, a president or a provost or somebody else in the organization wants to have some sort of a team building exercise where, you know, we understand the different personalities amongst the team that's working together. There is value in that. So I don't say that to make fun of it or anything. There is a lot of value in doing that. But I also think it's incredibly fascinating to be able to look at those assessments of who you are and how you think and be able to see, as you said, where are the places that I tend to, you know, have very high marks on different types of cognitive functions, where places where it's a little bit lower. Mm-hmm. I think having insight on that in and of itself raises your awareness of sort of how you navigate through things. Maybe another analogy is you sort of get some idea of what your blind spots are, and you get some idea of what your default approaches are, and that's valuable to know that. So let me ask a question in a slightly different way. I remember when I was going through my graduate program, there was a lot of discussions about learning styles at that point. I think that some of those discussions have sort of fallen by the wayside, but one of the suggestions for classroom teachers was to teach around the circle of different learning styles. I still see value in that. And I think about some of the really progressive educators that I know of in the surrounding school districts of Athens that are using things like place-based education, doing a lot of work, getting out of the classroom into literally the field in some cases, but certainly the community. When I hear examples like that of teaching strategies, even if the teachers that are doing that, you know, do not have a background in neuroscience like you do, it feels to me like they're doing something that would unlock the ability of students to experience things in multiple ways, which seems like a really good idea, you know, from a brain stretching standpoint.
I would love to be more specific with my references, but I can tell you that there is some fascinating research about the connection of our brain health with nature. And in general, for sure, environment matters. There's no question. You know, I mentioned earlier, well, we typically change the environment around the learner, but let's look at changing the learner and let's do both. Let's see an opportunity to give every student their best chance cognitively. And one of the, again, conditions of, and I don't know, it's not chicken or egg, it's both. It's that those external conditions to ready a child to learn. And I think there is a distinction between learning and growing. I know it. We say it together, but I do think there's, sounds a bit pedantic, but learning is the acquisition, I think, of a skill or of content or of knowledge. And the growing part, and maybe there's both, but the when I talk about growing, I mean actually the brain. I mean the brain, the brain structurally and functionally changing so that as it changes, the learning becomes even more accessible, even more efficient, effective. So I think there is a distinction between growing and learning. But in general, yes, that though learning, engaging in nature, there's no question that it is good for the brain, body, and soul. Absolutely. I love the when my kids were very young, I explored outdoor education. We have a fabulous, I'm based in Toronto, we have a fabulous publicly funded outdoor education program. And I was couldn't line up all the pieces to make it happen. But there's absolutely the brain, let's, in the spirit of, mm-hmm. of analogies, the brain is a garden and you need both the seeds and the right conditions for them to grow. So for sure, there is a lot of important and beautiful examples of creating positive and even nature-based opportunities for children to breathe differently, to engage with whatever their surroundings are differently, an incredibly safe and stimulating environment.
I want to go back to the topic of learning disabilities. I think just to tie a bow around our discussion on that, if we view the brain as being something that can adapt and change and can react to stimuli, especially if somebody has sort of training in this area of neuroscience, how does that cause us then as educators to think differently about differently abled learners, or what has been termed as, of course, learning disability by some? How does that change our perspective on what that is, how we as educators react to it?
I think it's profound. I think it can be profound. I think it changes, exactly as you said, how we understand that learner and how we understand what is our responsibility towards that learner. And it even changes the questions we're asking. Even changes not just how can I help you endure this, how can I get you through this, but how can I strengthen the part of your brain that is making this hard? So it really can change the question we're asking, never mind the action we might take. So, and even without, you know, I will say, obviously I'm biased. My belief is that every school should have a daily cognitive program that every child, not just those who learn differently, but there are schools that have a daily cognitive exercise. They may have a different cognitive exercise in every grade to match their developmental need. It's no different than a daily physical exercise. It's a different brain exercise. So of course, my near vision, the near future, I have no doubt will have that set up. But in the meantime, to ask the question differently, what is likely the cognitive function that is underperforming here that may be causing this particular moment in time? And what can I do differently? If I don't have a cognitive program, then maybe we perhaps can work around that experience for the time being, and understand what it is. Understand that it's not a motivation issue. It's not an effort issue or lack of effort. It's not a question of intelligence. Of course, we know that that's the operational definition of having a learning disability, is that they're at least of average intelligence. And we both know that there are many people who are off the charts of bright, bright, bright folks, and they have specific difficulties or differences. So, asking the question differently from the onset.
I want to use an analogy, and I don't want this analogy to minimize what for some students and families could be, you know, profound need for improvement in certain areas, and that is a lifelong challenge, perhaps. Mm. But at a point in my life, not that long ago, I was a basketball coach, and when you're dealing with younger players, especially children that are coming out of elementary school into the middle school time period, when a lot of athletics, basketball, football, et cetera, would start to become a bit more serious, one of the challenges that coaches immediately have is students being able to use their offhand. And so in basketball terms, you're going to have a shooting hand, which if you're right-handed, is your right hand that will shoot. But you have to be able to dribble. You have to be able to do layups, all using your left hand. And that's one of the critical steps. If that doesn't get solved when a student gets to middle school or junior high, then by the time they get to high school, they're probably no longer playing basketball because it becomes so debilitating for them as a player that they're just not able to perform at the same level. I use that as an analogy because, and you actually pointed to the idea of physicality at one point, but I use that as an analogy because if I have a cognitive thing that needs to be developed and I keep going without me understanding what it is and having someone that can help me understand ways to account for that and improve it, then as time goes on, there is the potential for that to have a bigger and bigger impact on my, you know, my ability as a student to attain information through learning and then to be able to grow as an individual. So I totally buy into, you know, what it is that you're saying. And I think there's a lot of, there are a lot of analogies, and I don't think that the sports analogy is a perfect one, but if we think about that one thing, it sort of shows how we just need to pay attention to it, identify it, and then help a person contextualize how to get better at it. I mean, you can use drills in basketball, and you can use learning strategies in a classroom.
Scott, sport is the best analogy to use, and I find it fascinating that we don't use it enough in learning, in school, because even if, you know, I don't mean to, there will be athletes and less athletes, but we all appreciate, we all watch the Olympics. We all see the incredible effort. Well, in fact, maybe we don't see it, but we need to see to achieve that level of performance, of execution of their learned skill, the effort, the engagement, the commitment, the motivation, the complexity of building progressive capacity skills to achieve that is so deeply important. The other piece that I find we don't use enough, and I know probably as a basketball coach, you probably do tend to, it bleeds into classrooms, academic classrooms, but even this concept of effort and struggle and failing, trying and failing. There's been some positive growth mindset conversations in the last few years, but athletes know that they're not going to win every game. And in fact, if you're a good coach, you will tell your team that you will learn more in that loss than you learn in that win. And the same goes for the classroom. The same goes for the brain. The brain needs to be presented with a challenging concept, a challenging task, a challenging stimuli in order to effortfully reach to it. Because if it's too easy, the brain's on autopilot. It's shooting with their dominant hand. And frankly, if it's too complex, if you're asking them to shoot with their feet or, you know, even backward, that's too complex. There's going to be no benefit to that. Neuroplastic training, just like basketball training, we need to set the task just above their current level of functioning so that there's effort and engagement and motivation to reach that target. And they may not get it on the first go or in the 100th go. But when they get it, there's change. There's cognitive change. In the case of sport, there tends to be physical change, although there's cognitive change too. I mean, there's reaction time, reflexes, decision-making, all of those cognitive elements that go into sport. I think it's an incredibly powerful analogy for students to recognize this isn't going to be easy. And I find this a fascinating. I've just done a piece of writing about struggle. And I think struggle has kind of earned a really bad name recently. And I think it's devastating. It's not serving us. And I think, you know, there's lots of reasons why. And one of them is, I think, our convenience culture, that we have everything conveniently available and accessible to us. But struggle is not a bad thing. There is such thing as, you know, productive struggle. And I will say, I'm going to qualify that. Those who learn differently, that's a different kind of struggle.
Right.
And that is an inefficient struggle. And that is a deeply painful struggle. And I think I would not want to get off this conversation today, Scott, without naming that, you were one of the lucky ones. That there are very clear statistics that provide the relationship between learning difficulties, learning disabilities, struggles in school with a future that is very frankly not bright, that there is lack of employment or underemployment. There are mental health issues, more likely to have addiction issues, more likely to have interpersonal and relationship issues. The stats are very clear. And what ends up happening is needing great teachers, needing a family that is present and privileged enough to set up an ideal environment for that student, because it will be more difficult for them. And many, many millions of people around the world don't have that opportunities. And as I said, statistically speaking, it's a very different experience than what you had. And I'm not, you know, it's not to say that you weren't deserving of that and worked incredibly hard to achieve that. And you were, as I said, one of the lucky ones, I would say. So yes, struggle. I know I appreciate I'm naming lots of different themes here, but that struggle is an incredibly important part of learning. Let me summarize that. Struggle is an incredibly important part of learning and a necessary part of learning. And let's not lose that productive, effortful struggle and make sure that a task we're giving our students is not too easy and not too difficult, but not also at their capacity, just beyond it.
Yeah.
Shooting with their right, with their non-dominant hand, and make sure that is productive struggle, that it's towards ultimately a growth or a learning opportunity, and not just pain and struggle and frustration that comes from many learners who learn differently or have difficulties when they're expected to learn the same way as their peers. And given a certain cognitive profile, it's very difficult for them to do that.
Tara, I want to end with a question, and it's going to be incredibly unfair because it's a big question and we're probably getting towards where we need to bring an end to the podcast for listeners' sake. But I think it's fair to ask the question and see what your thoughts are on it. So artificial intelligence is something that's taking over big aspects of, you know, what it is that we do on a daily basis. And over the summer, I started to read really interesting, and I'm sure it preceded the summer as well, but when I was delving deeply into it, there were a lot of people I was reading over the summer that said, you know, their concern at this stage is not that artificial general intelligence was going to take over the world and humans would become slaves to the AI machine, but rather it was that we would start to rely on artificial virtual assistants to such a degree that we would stop thinking through things ourselves. This is the biggest softball ever. What are your thoughts on AI and how it could change literally the way that we think?
You're very good, Scott, because that is a perfect segue from our last piece about struggle. Struggle is critical. Effort is critical to our well-being as humans. And I don't mean to be too, you know, ethereal it's probably why we evolved as human beings as successfully as we did. We work together as a community, literally together, right? Eye to eye, improving our mirror neurons and all the good stuff that comes out of socializing and problem solving together, and through effort, through learning, through trying and failing and trying again. So I don't mind saying that absolutely there is a very interesting danger, frankly. There's a cliff that we are at right now. And I'm not anti-AI. I think it's a fascinating tool that can solve some incredible big questions, like maybe climate, or like disease, or like economies, because it can take trillions of data points and bring them together to solve big problems. I am very excited about it. It also can do things that are already easy for us, but are just a pain.
Yeah.
So if they are replacing our post-it notes, right? Or if they are, if I never have to look at another Excel sheet again, I will be forever grateful to AI. But if we, exactly what you said, Scott, if we outsource thinking, and if we outsource generative problem solving, never mind social connection, but if we outsource reasoning, and if we defer to a very sophisticated system that was built by us, but it's a very sophisticated system, then if we have AI doing the heavy lifting, the heavy cognitive lifting that our brains need to do, if we don't use it, we lose it. Our brains will prune away the circuits we stopped using.
One thing so I teach a freshman class starting in just a few weeks. And of course, we're going to talk about AI in that class. And one of the things I'm going to experiment around with them in talking about AI is that the skills that it takes to use good prompts, and, you know, in the field of communication, we're creating visual images, we're creating video, we're creating, like ChatGPT text-based responses, data analysis like spreadsheets. And so one of the things I'm going to talk to them about is that skill set of doing good prompts from the frame of it being metacognitive. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how that's going to go, Tara, but I'm trying to think about how to have the conversation with them that, just as you said, that if you're using AI to replace behaviors that are rote, not all that challenging, so that you can focus on the challenging part, then there's growth there. And so that's what I want to try to get to them with. Well, Tara, I have so enjoyed getting to meet you and having this conversation with you. It's been very fascinating, you know, to get your perspective on how the brain grows and how we as educators can adapt to that. So I just really appreciate your time, and what a great guest to kick off the new season with.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for getting me excited again about about students and about what many educators are facing right now. They're heading back to the classroom in North America. They are facing a group of kids of all ages who are ready to learn and grow, and all of the opportunities that students and educators face right now, challenges and opportunities. And thank you for giving me this space to hopefully insert a new or at least a somewhat fresh idea into your listeners' minds and brains, which is, put the brain into this, whatever conversation they're exploring. And I think it will serve them well. Thank you.
Absolutely. My guest today has been Tara Bonner. She's the Chief Neuroeducation Officer at Aerosmith Program. If you're interested in what Tara has been talking about, we will provide a link to the Aerosmith Program website in the text accompanying the podcast. And if you go to the website, you will notice that they have a lot of material that is openly available, blog written posts and things like that, YouTube content that's very fascinating. And so I would encourage listeners who want to learn more about neuroplasticity of the brain to check out the Arrowsmith Program's website as a starting point for that. Thank you all for listening to this first episode of our new season. Special thanks, as always, goes to April Koska and Trinity Sweet. They're the associate producers of the podcast. This podcast is produced by WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. Thank you for listening, and we hope everyone has a great day.